Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, a rare show of agreement from lawmakers in Washington. The Senate has approved a bill that would provide $1.1 billion for research and preparation for the Zika virus already showing up in patients in this country, those who have been traveling from South and Central America. But the real concern is what happens when the mosquito population makes landfall in the coming weeks. So this is some good news.
Although the president had asked for $1.9 billion, and this is largely to support research at the National Institutes of Health, where they're hard at work to develop a vaccine along with possible treatments for those who become infected. You know, Zika had largely been considered an innocuous pathogen until the link to serious birth defects became apparent as it swept through Latin America, and that has just added an immense sense of urgency to this research.
So far, there's no specific treatment for Zika other than riding out the virus symptoms, rash, fevers, aches, and the like. But the threat to pregnant women and their unborn children is very real, and so far, there's not a lot that women can do other than being vigilant around avoiding mosquito bites. Not an easy thing to do in certain parts of this country.
Well, not at all, Mark. And Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease does feel pretty confident, though, that there'll be a workable vaccine by the end of the year, which is very good news. But for now, we have to brace for mosquito season and promote public health strategies that minimize the population of mosquitoes and make sure the public utilizes mosquito repellents when going outside.
It's an example of how science requires diligence and rapid response research paradigm so that we can understand the nature of the emerging public health threats like Zika. And it's a never-ending struggle.
And all manner of research is vital to the integrity of a robust healthcare system. And today, our guest is a researcher of another kind. Dr. Lisa Simpson is president and CEO of Academy Health, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank of researchers analyzing health systems through the better use of data. She's renowned in this field, and we are really looking forward to having her on the show.
Academy Health has taken over the sponsorship of Health Data Palooza in Washington, a gathering of health activists dedicated to liberating the data. It's an impressive gathering of luminaries in this field. She'll have much to share with us about this year's event.
And Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Lisa Simpson in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Congress has been acting on a number of some of the bigger threats to population health in the country, voting to approve $1.1 billion of the president's $1.9 billion request in the Zika battle. That money slated for accelerated research on vaccines and protections for pregnant women who become infected. Scientists are working feverishly to beat the arrival of the mosquito that carries Zika in the U.S. And the president has also asked for $1.1 billion to launch an offensive against the opioid addiction problem, claiming some 47,000 lives in 2014 alone. White House drug czar Michael Botticelli warning, without additional resources, many more people will die. The number of uninsured children has dropped significantly across the country, especially in the underserved populations. According to a recent study by the Urban Institute, the number of children eligible for coverage in SHIP or Medicaid rose to 91% in 2014, up from about 81% in 2008. About 4.5 million children are still uninsured in this country, about two-thirds of them CHIP or Medicaid eligible. While the medical world scrambles to incorporate the game-changing opportunities with genomics, a government initiative leading to the mapping of the human genome back in 2008, now the attention is turned to another medical frontier about which little is known. Microbiomes getting much-needed infusion of support from the Obama administration, which just pledged $121 million to launch a microbiome project. The bugs that inhabit a person's body believed to have as much to do with health as the genomic blueprint. The microbiome quest also being supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And folks who spend a lot of time driving around in their cars might find a negative impact from that driver's side sun exposure. Higher rates of cataracts in the left eye being reported and more skin cancers on the left side of the face. Study published in the journal JAMA Ophthalmology showed a higher rate of these conditions among Californians who spent a lot of time in their cars in the ubiquitously sunny weather. And many of the car windows failed to provide adequate additional protection. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Lisa Simpson, President and CEO of the Academy Health, which works to improve health and performance of the health system by supporting the production and use of evidence to inform policy and practice. A pediatrician and health policy researcher, Dr. Simpson is Deputy Director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality from 1996 to 2002, and was a member of the National Advisory Committee for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholar Program. Dr. Simpson is an elected member of the Institutes of Medicine and has earned numerous awards, including the Excellence in Public Service Award from the American Academy of Pediatrics. She earned her medical degree at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, and her master's from the University of Hawaii. Dr. Simpson, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark. It's really a pleasure to be here. And thank you for the work that you do for the underserved in Connecticut. Actually, one of my most fond memories of my residency and shortly after that was working in community health centers in Hawaii, one in Waianae and one in Waimanalo.
We know Waianae well. We know them very well out there. You know, your organization has just come off an incredible event, the 7th Annual Health Data Palooza, which was held in Washington, D.C., and a great gathering of data liberation champions everywhere. You had Vice President Biden, Secretary Burwell, Todd Parks, Farsad Mustashari, Susanna Fox, Karen DeSalvo, and so many great luminaries, as well as many patient advocates were there this year, promoting goals in line with your mission at Academy Health, which is to seek to improve health and the performance of the health system through use of data. Before we delve into the work of the Academy, we're anxious to hear about Health Data Palooza. What were some of the notable highlights?
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. The energy was really palpable. Like you said, there are a bunch of energetic folks. And I think it's going to be very hard to top Vice President Joe Biden's talk. It was inspiring, moving. I mean, sitting in the room, you could hear a pin drop. He really captivated the audience and both acknowledged the importance of the work of the folks in the audience, but also challenged us to do even more to really accelerate the pace of research and leverage data across the silos that exist. Another highlight for me was that we achieved the Patients Included certification. This is a new self-certification that you can do for conferences. So there were patients, as you noted, not just in the audience, but on the panels, on the steering committee. We had a great consumer Shark Tank adaptation. So I feel it really kept the conversation going and real. The other thing is this year we made a real effort to make sure that we didn't just talk about Medicare and private sector data, but also data at the state level because of certainly many people, including myself, concern about vulnerable populations and Medicaid and CHIP. So we, thanks to the Milbank Quarterly and Milbank Fund, we were able to bring in more state folks. And there were a couple panels that then very directly took on the issues that influence health, going beyond just healthcare and looking at social determinants and the environment, and how do we bring in the data across those sectors to help really design strategies that meet people's needs and lives where they are. So those were some of the highlights for me.
Well, Dr. Simpson, I think the country shares your feeling about how powerful Vice President Biden's speech was and his willingness to outline his own struggles to gain access to research data that might have helped his son, Beau, in his struggle with brain cancer. It was very, very powerful. But, you know, we've always heard that a important function is to bring IT entrepreneurs together to be hackers in some ways, to hack solutions to the problems that we have of sharing data in a timely fashion. Maybe you could speak just a little bit about one or two promising new initiatives that were discussed that might have the potential for expediting and sharing this trove of health data. And I really appreciate that you spoke about also getting at data at the state level. And of course, we're sitting at this incredible intersection always of health and public health, primary care, tertiary care, community health, all works together.
So I think one certainly brand new initiative was the one announced by Fred Trotter who, you know, wrote the book Hacking Healthcare. And Fred is, you know, a data hacktivist. And because of his incredible work in this space, he actually won this year's Health Data Liberator Award. But he also released a new data set called Mr. Pup for Medicare referring provider utilization. But it's really important because it helps understand which providers are referring patients to which labs and other providers. So it, now it, this open data source can help folks understand referral patterns, maybe some hotspots. Getting the data out is just the first step. And then all the innovation and creativity of the broader community can take that data and try to turn it into actual knowledge, innovation that helps patients. Another example from the meeting was from Phil Payne, who, and he talked about a new platform, Cielo, that he's developing collaboratively with Academy Health. And this is a platform where you can share data and code together for de-identified data in public spaces. And we're also, they're developing a private space for sensitive data. And it's specifically designed to promote collaboration in health research and quality improvement and health analytics. So it's part of work that we're doing to really promote this culture of open science and health analytics. And there was a panel on open science as well. The last one I want to mention is that we also manage a learning community. We abbreviate it to call it PopCop, or Population Health Community of Practice, where we're bringing together leaders at the city health department and state health department to talk with each other, not about just the traditional sort of public health data sets of surveillance, et cetera, but to actually look at innovations of bringing in electronic data, bringing in other kinds of derivative data, whether it's patient-reported outcomes or, you know, your Fitbit, to really help enhance the core public health function.
You know, Dr. Simpson, you've had a great history of research. You're both at ARC back in 1996, and through the years, you've seen the technologies and data streams change. But the principles of quality research remain the same. Could you talk to our listeners about some of the research areas you're focused in on now at Academy and Health? How have they evolved from your earlier days of quality research?
Sure. As we like to say, the volume, variety, and velocity of data has changed dramatically. So, you know, historically, I think the research community throughout the country was, you know, very much focused on either national surveys or administrative claims data, transactional data. Mm-hmm. But now we're seeing the opportunity to complement that and expand it dramatically with other types of data, whether it's from electronic health records, patient-reported outcomes, or, you know, the quantified self. And, you know, every action that we take online is a data point, and really trying to bring that in so that we have an understanding that's much more in real time. Our goal is really to work with our members and the community to accelerate everybody's ability to use these new data and to learn from each other. There's a lot of innovation, but there's also a lot of false starts because this is new and complicated. And it's really important to share not just the bright spots and the successes, but also the setbacks, what didn't work, so that other people don't waste their time. So one of the projects that we have right now is working with the Office of the National Coordinator, the Community Health Peer Learning Program, and that's looking at data across sectors for population health. So we have 10 geographic community and 5 subject matter expert communities all coming together to look at different aspects of population health. Another initiative that we have, the Electronic Data Methods Forum, has provided small grants to researchers to look at such issues as the development of E, or electronic clinical quality measures, again, moving from a sort of non-integrated, you know, layered on top quality performance measurement enterprise to really seeing quality measures become a byproduct of clinical workflow. And then the last example I'd like to give you is something that we do a lot of, and it's really called research on research. And by that, I mean we look at patterns, trends, and future needs of the field overall and the users of research. For example, we manage a data set for the National Library of Medicine called HSR-PRAJ, which tracks all health services research funded by over 250 public and private sector organizations. One of the most recent ones we did looked at disparities research and how has that research as a field changed over time. You know, in the early part of this past decade, a lot of the research that was funded was looking at documenting disparities But as the decade moved on, we saw more and more studies addressing, well, what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. How do we actually reduce disparities? The proportion that's looking at interventions has actually gone up by 90%, which is, I think, very important. Health services research, a significant portion of it is sort of backward-looking and descriptive and explanatory, which is critical, mm-hmm. but increasingly we've got to have interventional and evaluative answers to this sort of, well, what works? And some of my personal research, obviously as a pediatrician and a child health services research, I look at various aspects of child health care. And so last year we published a study on pediatric hospitalizations for behavioral health issues. Mm. We're just about to have one come out on oral health, which is a big, big issue, mm-hmm. particularly for children on Medicaid. And next year we're going to look at rehospitalizations for children.
Well, this is very exciting. And at Academy Health, you are looking at everything from social determinants, organizational structures, technologies, financing, cost, health policies, all these things that affect health outcomes. But they also have to affect our care delivery systems, right, if we're going to affect yep. change. And I wonder, I know you keep your feet firmly on the ground while your head is in the data clouds, but maybe you could share with our listeners a little bit about how this work is actually impacting high-quality care delivery system.
We're seeing incredible advances. And in fact, I'd like to point you to a new journal that we launched 3 years ago as part of our work in the electronic data methods form. It's called eGEMS, and it's peer-reviewed and open access, so any of your listeners can get access to it if they're interested in work around all these new data sets, because we realize that because this is so new, we need to sort of learn how to learn again mm-hmm. and how to use these new data sets. And so there are a number of different papers in there, appreciating the nuance of daily symptom variation to individualize patient care, new paradigms for patient-centered outcomes research in electronic medical records. Mm-hmm. So it's really sort of taking grounded clinical issues and then saying, well, in this new world, how do we do this? The other thing that we're seeing is that more and more delivery systems are saying, we need more in-house capability of really well-trained researchers, but who are interested and, you know, get really jazzed about doing work about care delivery today. And so we partnered, coming out of a group that we founded several years ago called the Health Services Research Learning Consortium, which represents the training program directors and the employers. We established the Delivery System Science Fellowship. And this fellowship is a partnership with 10 leading delivery systems around the country, Mayo, Intermountain Healthcare, Geisinger, the VA, and several others, do a national recruitment competition for really well-qualified health services researchers who then go through basically a match program and get selected for one of those delivery systems and then go work as embedded researchers. Because this allows them an opportunity to see the trove of data that really exists now in delivery system settings. So we've placed between 5 and 9 delivery system fellows, and we gather, you know, online, but we also get them all together at our annual research meeting. And I think it's really important to sort of start breaking down the silos, not just of data, but the silos that have existed between academia and delivery.
We're speaking today with Dr. Lisa Simpson, President and CEO of Academy Health, a national organization serving the needs of health services and policy research, a pediatrician and health policy researcher. Dr. Simpson also served as deputy director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. You know, we were struck by something that Farzad Mustashari said at the Health Data Palooza that was pretty telling. He noted that 7 years ago, almost no one heard about electronic health records. And, you know, I guess that's not kind of surprising. You know, Twitter's was created in 2006 and Facebook in 2004. And in so many ways, we've come so far. And could you talk about how outcome data from electronic health records and claims databases are relatively new tools for research and are enhancing your ability to conduct more in-depth research?
It's a whole new world. And of course, the research community is adapting and evolving because they're using not just existing robust methods, but developing all kinds of new methods to use these new data streams. And it's not straightforward. You know, there are issues because they come often from different proprietary vendors. But the real beauty and power of them is the incredible richness of clinical detail that's now available that was never available from the more traditional claims data. And when we've done studies looking at rehospitalizations for children, you can adjust with as much as you can in the Medicaid claims data set, but you just can't adjust enough for the complexity of the kids who are cared for in dedicated children's hospitals. They just are sicker. So by bringing in the really rich, granular clinical data, you can start understanding not just the average of a population subset, but really start creating much more specific in-depth phenotypes for smaller groups of patients, using all the data points to create much more specific phenotypes of types of patients. You're helping to develop predictive analytics and prospective care management plans that are much more tailored to individual patients.
Well, Dr. Simpson, I would say that there's without doubt never been a more fertile time for health services and policy researchers than now. And you are overseeing research in so many of these big impactful areas, certainly CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, Medicaid, payment reforms. Anything else you'd like to say about some of these initiatives that you're overseeing and the partnerships that you've forged in order to be able to address them?
I'm glad you brought up the point, partnerships, Margaret, because that is very much a fundamental way that we go about our work, partnership with our members or organizations who share a passion for improving health as we do. I earlier had mentioned our ONC work. It's really fascinating. We're working with these communities to help identify data solutions, accelerate local progress, and really disseminate educational and other resources to support progress on population health. Connecting them so that they're learning from each other is a big part of what we do. You mentioned CHIP and Medicaid. So we are delighted, for example, to have two state-focused networks that we work with in partnership. One of them is the Network of Medicaid Medical Directors, and these are the senior-most clinician in each state Medicaid program. We've worked with them on projects ranging from early elective deliveries and rehospitalizations, so really tackling high-priority issues that they see in their populations. And you mentioned payment reform. Well, we're just starting a project that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is funding us to do to look at that intersection of payment reform and population health. You know, everybody's talking about this. We moved to value, not volume. That's easy to say. How do you actually do that on the ground? So trying to, again, bring the innovation from around the country together and then get that information out to more folks more quickly.
Dr. Simpson, a big part of the work that you do at Academy Health is to provide nonpartisan analysis of the effectiveness of these health policies and how they've impacted the health as well as the health systems around the country. I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about some of your findings in that area, but also how are you all organized? How are you supported?
We are nonpartisan, and one of the ways we maintain our neutral brand in Washington, because it can get pretty heated at times, you know, we have an advocacy role, but it's quite limited. We advocate for science policy. We work with a committee of our board of directors to help shape that policy, but it's about policies related to funding for research, funding for data, and then for the freedom of both that research and data, to get access to data, et cetera. And so we don't weigh in with opinions or perspectives or taking sides on things like the Affordable Care Act or MACRA, and that allows us to stay focused on science policy. So we facilitate their conversation by bringing the evidence forward. About 18 months ago, some staff in Congress were looking at legislation they were drafting on value-based insurance design. And we said, well, we have a number of experts in our membership who, you know, have done tremendous studies on this. And so we brought them to Washington and had a, you know, small closed-door congressional staff conversation so that they could hear directly from the experts at Harvard and elsewhere who were doing work on value-based insurance design. We do that also with the executive branch. We just did a workshop yesterday on price transparency, bringing in six grantees at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to look at different dimensions of price transparency, to be in a room with senior leaders from the executive branch to talk about, well, what are we learning about this? When does it work? What are the challenges? really making sure that evidence is part of the policy conversation.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking today with Dr. Lisa Simpson, President and CEO of Academy Health, serving the needs of health services and policy research through the better use of data. You can learn more about their work by going to academyhealth.org or follow them on Twitter at Academy Health. Dr. Simpson, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Margaret and Mark. It was a real pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the Zika virus is still in the news as Congress considers President Obama's $1.9 billion request for emergency funds to combat the virus. We found misleading claims in some senators' statements in favor of it. Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota said Zika will be everywhere in the United States. Senator Marco Rubio similarly said it can be in any state in the country. Health experts project local clusters of Zika cases in some states, not widespread transmission. There are now 45 countries and territories worldwide with active Zika transmission, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Scientists believe Zika spreads in three ways: through mosquito bites, via sexual contact with a male, or from mother to child during pregnancy. Why won't it spread widely in the U.S.? Tom Frieden, head of the CDC, has said that Zika primarily spreads through the bite of certain mosquitoes in places that don't have air conditioning or screens. Denise Jameson, chief of the Women's Health and Fertility branch of the CDC, also has said that experience with other diseases carried by the same mosquitoes shows that the continental U.S. would likely see a small number of cases. The CDC provides maps for the estimated ranges of the mosquitoes that can transmit Zika, showing that the mosquitoes primarily thrive in the southern states and Puerto Rico. In order for an outbreak to occur, says the CDC, people infected with Zika must enter the U.S., and the mosquitoes that transmit the virus must bite an infected person during the first week of infection. And then the infected mosquito must live long enough for the virus to multiply and for it to bite another person. Public health officials don't believe it will be everywhere in the United States. The CDC reported 658 locally acquired cases in U.S. territories, primarily Puerto Rico. The continental U.S. has seen zero locally acquired cases and 472 travel-related ones. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Each year, more than 1 million babies die at birth, and another 3 million die within the first few weeks of life, often from preventable causes. And when babies are born prematurely, the risks escalate. Newborns, and particularly preemies, have a considerable amount of difficulty regulating their own body temperature, and without access to incubators, babies in the third world often succumb to hypothermia. That got former Stanford MBA student Jane Chen thinking, how do we develop a low-cost solution to the problem?
My team and I realized what was needed was a local solution, something that could work without electricity, that was simple enough for a mother or a midwife to use. We needed something that was portable, something that could be sterilized and reused across multiple babies, and something ultra low cost compared to the $20,000 that an incubator in the U.S. costs.
Speaking at a recent TED Talk, Chen said that they developed a cocoon-like device called, simply, Embrace, a thermal body wrap that encases the baby and helps regulate body temperature for up to 6 hours.
Looks like a small sleeping bag for a baby. It's waterproof. There's no seams inside, so you can sterilize it very easily. But the magic is in this pouch of wax. This is a phase change material. It's a wax-like substance with a melting point of human body temperature, 37 degrees Celsius. You can melt this simply using hot water, and then when it melts, it's able to maintain one constant temperature for 4 to 6 hours at a time, after which you simply reheat the pouch. And it creates a warm microenvironment for the baby.
And Chen and her developers have managed to keep the cost of the Embrace baby warmer at around $25 per unit. Since launching the product in 2010, they estimate that over 150,000 babies' lives may have been saved with the device, which is easy to sterilize and designed for multiple uses. The Embrace infant warmer has earned numerous international awards for design and efficacy, a low-cost, high-tech, portable temperature regulator designed to regulate preemies' body temperatures to ensure that they not only survive premature birth, but ultimately thrive as well. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.